Welcome to M&A Plus, the art after the deal, the podcast that dives into the dynamic world of mergers and acquisitions, where strategy meets execution. I'm your host, Lisa Scott, guiding you through insightful conversations with M&A business leaders, integrators, and legal professionals. Join us as we unravel the complexities, challenges, and success stories that shape the ever-evolving landscape of mergers and acquisitions. Brought to you by Intuitive Edge, the go-to elite legal services provider that's revolutionizing how private equity and corporations streamline contract review and transition during divestitures or acquisitions. At Intuitive Edge, we're diving deep into what really makes or breaks the success of M&A deals. It's the art that follows the deal, the part where true value is either captured or lost. I'm thrilled to bring this topic to life, drawing from my journey of bridging a critical gap in the M&A world. So join me on this exciting journey as we unfold the layers of M&A Plus and transform the way deals are done. Welcome to M&A Plus, the art after the deal. Hello, and welcome to M&A Plus, the art after the deal, where the integrators are the heroes. Today's episode is called Beyond the Boardroom, Unpacking M&A and Leadership Wellness with Dr. Kevin. In this episode, we dive into the dynamics of mergers, acquisitions, and the critical role of leadership and employee well-being. We will explore a fascinating intersection, corporate changes, leadership, and the crucial aspect of employee wellness. I'm your host, Lisa Scott, and joining us today is Dr. Kevin Carlson with a K, a unique professional who wears two very important hats, that of a lawyer and a psychologist. Dr. Kevin has dedicated a significant part of his career to understanding how leadership styles impact employee well-being, especially during the turbulent times during a merger or acquisition. Dr. Kevin, it's great to have you with us.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So let's get started. Before we get into the main topics of our discussion, could you share a little bit about your journey? What drew you to this unique combination of law and psychology, and what are some of your experiences in the M&A space?
I was born in a small town in South Dakota, and I was a high school debater. And I found out from being a high school debater that I understood the whole process of questions and answers, of confrontation as a way to get to understanding. And as a result of that, after I finished my PhD in forensic and clinical psychology at UT Southwestern in Dallas, I went straight to law school because I'd found during graduate school that many of my colleagues were afraid of using the court system, hated lawyers, and had irrational ideas about what the law was like or what court was like. And I found out that I was very comfortable in that setting. And so I became an expert in translating back and forth between the legal system and the mental health system. And it was a really good fit for my background, my skills, and my ability to integrate opposing points of view into a story that made sense to my clients. Mm-hmm. It turns out that most of my clients were executives, business owners, doctors, other professionals. And so they had the ability to rapidly acquire the information that I could provide to them about how to function effectively in the legal system. After about 10 years of doing litigation and spending my weekends in the office instead of doing fun things, I decided I was going to take a break. And so I took a sabbatical and I went to the Texas Instruments, where one of my friends had hired me to come into the Strategic Leadership Center to work with the top executives at Texas Instruments. And during the time that I was there, TI decided to undergo a major strategic overhaul. And so I got the opportunity to deal with in small group settings, the top 250 leaders at TI, in the midst of planning for a big strategic change. Then after my time at TI, I went back into the consulting world, where I had more opportunities to do corporate work as opposed to just legal work. And so I worked with executives from Blockbuster and Concentra and Mattel and some other Fortune 500 companies. Some of them were kind of on the verge of or had already gone through organization changes. Blockbuster was kind of on the verge of going out of business when I was there. And it was apparent that they had some leadership issues that were the direct consequent or the direct cause for their impending failure. So anyway, so I've had some interesting career experience in both the legal field and in the corporate world. And I enjoy the challenge of trying to translate what we now know about the psychology of organizations to people who are trying to either predict or prevent problems with major organizational changes.
Great. So I'm just curious, when you're hired for your engagements, like the ones that you just mentioned, are you hired because of your psychology background or more because of the legal background, or is it because it's a combination of both?
Sometimes it's more the psychology part. Sometimes it's because there's litigation issues and I'm able to recognize the issues and help people kind of avoid them or deal with them as they're happening. So it's kind of a combination of both. But I would say, you know, 2/3 psychology, 1/3 psychology and law stuff in the business side.
Thank you for providing your background. It's really interesting. I'd like to actually talk a little bit about like maybe some of the common challenges that you've seen in merger and acquisition scenarios. So I know that we have a slide here that we wanted to pull up that shows sort of like a general layout of a merger and acquisition and why they may be successful or not. So I know that some of the audience is probably listening to this on an audio only. So I want to just point out that we're going to include the visual in the information section of the podcast listing, so you can refer to it there. But I think given Dr. Kevin's background, you know, can you explain to us what are some of the main common challenges you see in companies, you know, during a corporate change like a merger or acquisition?
I found a slide from Forbes that's basically a very nice summary of what the 5 challenges are. And the first one is that there's a tendency for the acquiring company to overpay for the target company. And that's the result of insufficient due diligence, you know, corporate hubris. We know who these guys are and we can figure out what they're up to and what they're worth. Sometimes it's the result of the target company, you know, overly puffing their valuation or hiding their sales or revenue or, you know, operational profit stuff. And so that becomes a problem because, you know, if you end up buying something that's not worth what you paid for it, then making it work is really difficult. There's really a lot of poor integration. And Lisa, you know this better than I do. People kind of do the deal and then they stop. And for some reason, the follow-up just doesn't happen. And so these, you know, Lisa deals with contracts. So contracts that are inconsistent, contracts that aren't signed, contracts that are out of date, communication systems that don't work, IT systems that are incompatible, legacy IT systems that can't be upgraded and have to be, you know, replaced. All those kind of things sort of add to the unexpected cost, the oopses for the merger and acquisitions activities. You know, the third one's one that's more kind of central to me and something that I, you know, care about, which is leaders have a tendency not to communicate enough to their people about what's happening. And as a consequence, information voids are filled with rumors and all kinds of crazy stuff that makes the integration and the completion of the merger difficult. And sometimes the rumors that are flying around are so damaging to the valuation of the company or to the reputation of the company that the acquiring company goes, wow, we didn't know these guys were this crazy. We're not going to do this deal. So there's a real challenge, I think, for the upper level, C-level people to not understand the extent to which a merger and acquisition affects the work life of the folks at the front line and to communicate enough. I mean, it's almost always people don't communicate enough. So that's kind of my mantra for communication. Mm-hmm. Cultural classes, that's one of the things that I saw when I was at TI. Texas Instruments acquired several companies while I was there. And because I was a corporate guy, I kind of knew about kind of what was going on and visited a couple of the companies that we had acquired. And it was very apparent that there was kind of no, Texas Instruments is an incredibly world-class engineering company, but their ability to kind of pay attention to the people factors was missing in the deals that I was a witness to. They didn't understand the difference between the Texas Instruments culture, which is very well defined, and the companies that they're acquiring, who are usually smaller, with a leading edge tech that TI wanted and a group of highly, highly, highly talented engineers, but didn't have the TI culture. And so The TI people expected the guys that they acquired to just fall in line. And that never happened. I'm just saying, I'm not sure it does ever, but in my experience, that just didn't happen. And so the folks that got acquired were unhappy. The TI people were, miffed. And so it was a real challenge because there was insufficient attention paid to, what's the culture of the company we're acquiring? What do they believe is valuable? And how do they operate in ways that would work for us with our engineering culture? And finally, there's the last one is more obvious, but usually people do acquisitions because they believe they're going to be able to capture a bigger share of whatever market they're already in. And, the numbers are 90% of the time that does not happen. And the promises that C-level people make to their shareholders that this is going to increase shareholder value are false 60% of the time. And so I think that's also a communication and expectation issue where it's important for the leadership of both companies to get to know each other, really lay out kind of where they are truthfully and what their market looks like and what the future of their market looks like, and to reach a kind of a shared vision for the future of the combined company so that they can really move into the market they think they're going to capture effectively, and rarely happens. It just rarely.
Right. Good. Well, that's a good overview. It made me think of a lot of different things, one of which was, in general, it seems like one of the things that can solve a lot of these is planning. Or maybe I could add understanding to that too. Understanding and planning ahead of time, because in my experience, I see a lot of M&A acquisitions, they just happen. And it's like, right, there's not a whole lot of planning most of the time. There's so many things that could be solved and so much value that could be added just by the mere fact of planning, or even just sitting down and talking about these five things, at the right times. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, absolutely. And, one of the things I liked about your book, frankly, was how much you talked about the importance of putting together kind of a strategic plan for the integration. I mean, it's not just about the business, but the plan for the integration and how infrequently that actually happens. It's like people just think this is going to work, right? And, and so they have this belief it's going to work. Everybody says it's going to work. And so it's going to work. Well, yeah, no, that's not how that works. So yeah, I completely agree. More planning for the integrations, and especially that's part of this communications part that I'm stuck on all the time, which is, you have to communicate what's going to happen, when it's going to happen, who's responsible for making it happen. And those kinds of planning activities rarely happen for some reason.
Mm-hmm. Right. And the other comment that I would make, and this is a little bit off our topic here, but on the culture clash one, just from my own experience, because I worked in, a larger corporation for a long time and I had a career, and I started to get a little, I guess, antsy with some of the, innovative ideas that I had and things like that. And when I left the corporate world, I became an entrepreneur. Like, I had that mind, and I could just see how much of a clash that would be after you go through so much time on, full speed ahead on your ideas, on your ability to adapt, on your ability to create things really quickly. And then big company buys you. And then that, I guess it's almost like that memory of having the corporate structure limitations put on you again, right? So, I mean, I just sort of thought of that from my own experience on the culture clash, because a lot of the larger companies are buying those smaller, really innovative companies that have that type of culture, right?
Yep. Yes. And what I saw at TI is that big companies eventually go through the cycle where they, even though they start out being big time innovators, which TI was, I mean, developing the transistor is a pretty big innovation. But, so after 50 years in business, they stop being innovative and they start being more bureaucratic. And so at that point, there's a lot of pressure, I think, on the C-level people to go, what's the next best cool thing? And if the company culture has evolved to the point where innovation is no longer part of the culture, then they think, well, we'll go buy these innovative guys and they're going to make us innovative. Well, that's not what happens. The big companies squash the innovation in the new company, just like they did in their parent company. And so that's part of, I'm sure that's part of the reason things don't work out the way people think. No.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So this goes into, we're going to get to the topic on employee wellness. I did want to bring up one other thing. So I watched another podcast. There was a gentleman on there talking about how employee satisfaction. Maybe this is related employee wellness, but he was talking about how employee satisfaction has a direct impact on value creation, because with employee satisfaction comes more customer satisfaction. He was tying it into customer satisfaction. And I wanted to kind of just bring that up because, you know, it is a major value driver. And I'm thinking that when we get into the discussion on employee wellness, we can talk about how that relates to employee satisfaction and also retention even, right? Retention.
Yes. Right. Right. Richard Branson is one of my heroes. And Richard Branson's, you know, philosophy clearly stated over and over again is that, you know, happy employees make for happy customers. And so, and he understands that, you know, there's a top down, an influence from the leadership on down to the people at the front line, that if you're happy at work, then you're going to treat your customers with it in a different way than if you're not. And one of the examples I use all the time when I'm talking to corporate people is, you know, American Airlines, the majority of their employees are surly, and they couldn't have gotten this big if everybody was surly all the time, right? For the last, whatever it is, 50 years. But, you know, the upper level management and the frontline workers are not in sync. And so when you get an American Airlines airline and you rarely see a smiles, you know, in stark contrast to Southwest, when you walk in the door, it's like everybody is happy. And it's very clear that there's a much better alignment between the big picture airline vision and the folks who are, you know, doing goofy, you know, introductions to the, you know, fasten your seatbelt on Southwest. So, very important difference.
Okay. I'd like to move on and talk about your research on wellness programs. So I was reading about what you found, and you mentioned some surprising results in your research. So can you elaborate on what some of the surprising results were?
So I was hired to be an outside consultant for a big nonprofit organization that's interested in wellness. And they were trying to figure out what they were going to do next and kind of what's the next area where they should attack. And so given the rise in depression and anxiety, which is present at work, they decided that they should take a move towards mental health. And they wanted to see kind of what was available in terms of mental health programs to augment the existing wellness programs, which are mostly focused on, you know, physical activity and nutrition. And so I had the chance to, you know, spend some time kind of reviewing the literature about what's been going on with wellness programs, and results really were surprising to me. You know, there's the wellness industry is like $20 billion a year now in the U.S. And so, and most companies have, you know, a whole menu of wellness oriented programs that they offer to their employees, or some of them actually now demand that their employees participate in. And, you know, they're, some of them are kind of counseling, coaching oriented, and some of them are more physical fitness oriented. You know, some of them are meditation. I mean, the variety is just amazing. Big time nutrition programs, you know, eating programs, and it's the variety is really truly mind-boggling. I was I was really surprised at the variety, but I was also surprised because at the end of my research review, just a couple months ago, a major study was published with 46,000 subjects examining workplace wellness programs and their effectiveness. Given the amount of money that's being spent, whether they work or not, it's kind of an important question. And the results were nothing, zero effect from corporate wellness programs. $20 billion a year down the tubes, basically. And the only thing that was identified as being helpful toward employee wellness was paid time off, volunteer activities in the community. People identified that as being incredibly helpful for them, giving them purpose at work, helping them feel better about themselves, being more connected to communities where they were living. And so the outreach volunteer activities sponsored by the company were the ones that actually had an impact on employee well-being.
Okay. So just so I'm clear, so you're basically saying that all the money that's spent on quote unquote wellness programs that could include access to health, you know, mental health care or physical exercise programs or anything like that, you're saying none of those work. The only thing that really works is volunteer and paid time off. So that brings me to another question. What about compensation, like compensation plans? Because I know my podcast is focused on M&A, and there's a lot of, you know, things to consider when you're merging companies or, you know, with the compensation as well. And sometimes that's focused on, I would say, more than the other things, because they want to make sure that they have the right commissions and compensation so they can keep the, retain the employees. And, but what are your thoughts on that?
The way compensation works is interesting in wellness, which is people have to be paid enough so that they recognize that they're getting paid what's comparable to other people in the market. So, you know, if their job that's, I'm making this up, it's $40,000 a year job, and if for this company, but the market is $60,000 a year, they're going to be unhappy. I mean, they're just going to be unhappy. And if that's not an isolated incident, if that's a case where the whole company is, everybody is, you know, underpaid by, you know, 30%, then that's going to be a factor in the happiness of the folks who are there. Certainly, you know, M&A activity is driven by the attempt to increase shareholder value. And so the focus is, in my experience, is almost always on the money, not on the people. And so compensation becomes a way for people who are numbers oriented to try to deal with the people problems, but it's not, that's not the people problem. And so, you know, spending a lot of time on, do we need to raise our, you know, our compensation by 10% to make the market so we keep our good people here and they won't go away once the chaos starts, that's not going to work.
Right. Okay. So basically what you're saying is, you know, the compensation is important to the extent that you are in line with the market, because that's what everybody sees and that's what everybody expects. You can't pay somebody to be happy, basically.
Yeah, exactly.
Right?
Yeah, well said. Yeah, I'm going to use that. That's very good. Yes, you can't. You can't. It just doesn't work.
Right. And then the other part that I got from you is, it is worth it to think about things around employee wellness, like volunteering and paid time off. Those are the things that are going to actually contribute positively to an employee being happy or not.
Right. Right. And okay. It's not just paid time off, it's paid time off to volunteer.
Okay.
Right. Right. Mm-hmm. So I'm going to go volunteer.
And you're probably talking about all the time, but when there's a change and there's an M&A activity, it kind of exacerbates the issue altogether, because of, on top of that, you have the anxiety result of the change and the unknown that happens during M&A.
Yeah, exactly. One of the things I teach people when I'm teaching stress management is that, you know, one of the best ways to minimize stress is to minimize the number of decisions you have to make every day, because it's decisions that basically the energy sappers for people at work. And so in the day-to-day life of people at work, that means having a routine and being anchored in something besides your work. So if you're having some meaningful activity that you're engaged in besides work that provides you with some kind of stability, predictability, you know, kind of self-satisfaction, that's going to minimize the extent to which the chaos at work that is, it just is the inevitable result of an M&A activity. It minimizes the impact on people because they have some place outside of work to anchor themselves in terms of their satisfaction, life satisfaction.
Right. So I'm curious also to know, when you were talking about, you know, employee wellness programs that a lot of corporations have that aren't necessarily focused on the right thing. So what types of metrics were they using, and what types of metrics should they be using instead that is going to actually have a real impact on that corporate, you know, on their employees in a positive way?
Metrics for the wellness programs? It doesn't matter what you measure, that doesn't help.
Right? Okay.
So it's one of those things where, you know, once people decided that the solution to people feeling better about work was to provide all these extras, you know, physical fitness programs and yoga programs and meditation and, you know, stuff, the thing that didn't happen was go the next step and say, does this really make a difference? And so now we're $20 billion into every a year into this myth that wellness is going to help, right? And mm-hmm. so if you're talking about, you know, employee engagement, happiness, whatever, mm-hmm. feeling good about work, it doesn't matter how you measure it, it doesn't work, right? And so, right. so a lot of companies have, you know, wellness scorecards or you know, surveys or whatever that they send out, and you know, the numbers come back and people are going, yo, look at, we're like in the top 10% of all the companies in terms of our wellness programs. Well, good. Congratulations. It doesn't matter. So whether you're at the 1% or the, you know, 99%, that you're not doing the stuff that helps people feel good about work. So,
yeah. So I guess that's what I'm asking is, what could they do different? How do you measure it? Cause you know, companies have to measure everything. Right. So if they were going to show that they were successful in a genuine way, I guess, how could they measure it?
Deloitte, actually, the consulting company that did the big surveys about wellness at work. And I think what they found is, you know, you can offer your employees a kind of menu of activities or and wellness related things that are going to make a difference. Some of them will, some of them won't. Right. It's mm-hmm. kind of a plus minus thing. I think giving people a choice about whether they want to participate or not is a step in the direction of helping people feel more control at work. So, you know, that part's positive. But I think the ultimate solution is that, you know, you have to ask the people who are engaged in volunteer activities compared to people who are not volunteering. So what's the difference between your satisfaction at work and, you know, what we know based on the preliminary information is that, you know, if you give people the opportunity to volunteer in the community, they're going to be happy campers. And mm-hmm. if you're not doing that, regardless of all this other stuff that's going on, the engagement level of the folks that are in these companies that are not offering the opportunity mm-hmm. to connect in the community in a meaningful way, they're not going to be as happy, right?
Yeah. So that's interesting. Let's talk a little bit more about the volunteer activities. So what specific types of volunteer activities would be more beneficial than others? Because there's a lot of different, you know, volunteer situations. For example, a company could have like my company's actually done this, where we sponsored a family during Christmas time and everybody got together and got an item to put in a care package or, you know, something like that. I mean, and then there's other ones that, you know, you go run a marathon, you know, right. for a cause, right? So what right. are, I mean, what makes a volunteering activity more beneficial than another one?
Great question. And the answer is, I think it's going to be different for every person. And so the challenge for creating these outreach opportunities, volunteer activities in the community is going to be, you know, not being overly controlling at the corporate level and saying, here's the 10 things that we are connected to that we will support in terms of, you know, your volunteer activities. And if you have a different one, bring it to us and we'll consider it, so that the folks are going out into the community are basically volunteering for things they care about. Mm-hmm. You know, it's what we all do, right? I mean, there are things that are hooks for us, and we'll, you know, spend a lot of time of our free time and money supporting volunteer activities that are meaningful to us. And I think that's the key is everybody mm-hmm. has things that they care about, and if they're free to pursue those things in the community as volunteers with the support of their company, then mm-hmm. that matters to them.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. So how can companies integrate volunteering programs? Do you have any other examples of how a company could do that? Maybe talk about like a large one versus a small company, because obviously a large company is going to have more employees, but they also have more resources. Small company, like, I mean, I could give my company as an example. We're really small. I mean, I don't know that I could necessarily provide a lot of opportunities, you know, across the board for every person. I don't know, maybe I could. I mean, maybe that's not.
Good point. So, you know, the challenge always is, it, especially at the big corporate level, they think, oh my gosh, what's this going to cost us mm-hmm. and how are we going to make this work, right? And so I think the answer is that if you just gave people permission to go do their volunteer work and paid them like they were at work, then mm-hmm. people would find the places to go volunteer, and the corporate resources required would be zero almost. All I have to do is have a policy that says, we're going to give you, you know, one day a month, one day a week, whatever, one day a month probably, off, or one afternoon a week off to go do the soup kitchen thing, and we're going to pay you. You know, it's not going to be in your PTO. We're going to pay you for that, and we'll sponsor you. And, you know, if you want to tell us how it's going, or, you know, make requests for more people to join you, great. We'll, you know, we'll support you in that. But those are all at the corporate level. That's like, you know, that's in the noise. There's no big cost for that. So that's
right. That's a good example.
Culture issue, right? That's a culture.
Yeah. Right. Okay. I get it. So let's switch to leadership now. So you mentioned that managers are a major source of stress at work. So yes. What common mistakes are managers making in their interactions with team members?
Okay. So this comes from the Deloitte study. Deloitte was, you know, they're on top of it. And so they were getting lots of requests from their clients about, you know, we have high turnover, we've got high stress levels at work. You know, 1/3 of our people are depressed and anxious, you know, kind of what's the deal? And so I think it was 25 or 30,000 subject survey of people working for their clients and said, okay, to help us identify your major stress at work. And for more than 80% of the people that they talked to, the manager was the source of their problem. Or their stress. They identified the manager as a source of their stress. In my experience, that makes a lot of sense, actually. Managers, for the one thing, are under a lot of pressure to meet their metrics, right? And so they've got KPIs they've got to hit. And so managers are focused on the outcome, and they're not really focused on the people. And so and an astounding number, I forget the number, but it was incredible. Way over 50% of the folks said, when have you had a one-on-one talk with your manager? Never. Never. Hmm. And so, you know, for me as a leadership guy, it's like, how can you lead people you don't know? That's kind of my right. question. And so for people who are in the situation where they have a manager that report to, they have performance goals they're expected to hit, but they don't know the manager and the manager doesn't know them, this is like the worst. This is like the executive monkey studies from the early, you know, 50s. It's like, it's the amount of uncertainty is stress producing. And so when without a personal relationship with your manager, it's like horrible for the employee. So yeah, that was shocking.
Do you think that's more due to the corporate culture or the choice of manager?
Well, so, okay, good question. So I think it's both. And the reason I think that is because, you know, leadership at the top, the attitudes and especially the values trickle down through the organization. And so when you have leaders at the top who are unconcerned about people, they hire people who are not concerned about people, who hire more people who are not concerned about people until you get down to the level where, you know, you've got a big company with thousands of people who don't know each other and there's no corporate culture for communicating or connecting. It's about work, right? It's about the numbers. Mm-hmm. And so that's an unhealthy environment for everybody, but it's especially unhealthy if you're trying to be profitable because, like we were talking about earlier, you know, happy people make happy customers, and these people are not happy.
They're not there. That makes me think about emotional intelligence. I'm sure you've read the book.
Sure.
Emotional Intelligence, one of my favorite books that I've read. I know it's a very detailed book, but very interesting. What role, I guess, does emotional intelligence play in your sort of experience in effective leadership?
The emotional intelligence guys have made the case convincingly that emotional intelligence is a better predictor of success in business than intelligence, just regular intelligence. And that's because people who are emotionally intelligent are able to create, sustain, manage relationships with other people to get them to work together in order to be successful. And, you know, we all know if you're in business, you know, nobody's a success by themselves. You have to have a team. And so if you're a high EQ person, then you can develop the relationships with the people that you need, recognize the talent that's required for you to be successful, and maintain that culture as I would call it, that culture, successfully so that everybody works to their peak abilities. And so companies that don't focus on people, they hire managers that are focused on numbers, not on people. And so eventually that comes back to bite them because the folks that work for the managers that are focused on numbers and not on people, they get to be unhappy campers, and then they go, you know what? Mm-hmm. I can go someplace else where somebody will actually appreciate me, and they do. I used to teach a class on managing difficult people and at SMU, and the thing I would remind people was is that when people leave a company, exit interviews always demonstrate that there's one person who they think is responsible for their exit, mm-hmm. and it's almost always their manager.
Back to the M&A world. So how can M&A teams or integration teams better prepare for the human element of mergers and acquisitions or a corporate change?
The model that I think is going to be the most successful is the target company and the acquiring company, the C-level people need to meet and get to know each other. And however how much time that takes, it needs to be spent, because if the two teams can't get to know each other and develop a very positive working relationship and actually like each other, then they ought to pull the plug on the merger, because it's not going to work. Those relationships can be facilitated, and that process can be facilitated so that you maximize the opportunity for people to actually get to know each other and get rid of whatever their preconceived biases are about the other company and their culture. And then from then on, then it's a matter of taking that whole process and working it downward in both companies. I mean, mm-hmm. so that both companies, at the end of the merger process, a successful merger process, there should be a new culture that's a result of shared vision from people in both companies, not the value system or the vision of the acquiring company, because mm-hmm. that doesn't work. It just doesn't mm-hmm. work.
Okay. Yeah, that's really good. I appreciate your giving us some insights on that. So I wanted to let the audience also be aware of, you know, your publications and kind of maybe let us know what you've done and where your resources and publications are, where people can find them.
So I'm in the process of reorganizing all my online resources things, but the place to make initial contact with me is best on LinkedIn, because mm-hmm. I have a profile on LinkedIn that's relatively easy to find. Some of the resources are listed there. I'm in the process of redoing my website and putting all the resources in one place so that the things that I've written about these mm-hmm. issues, especially the business communication issues, are readily available on the website.
Great. So that's Dr. Kevin Carlson. That's how to find you on LinkedIn with a K.
Yes. With a K. Thank you.
Okay, good. Well, I really appreciate you joining us today. I think we got a lot of great insights, you know, insights into the psychological impacts of, you know, of the human impacts during M&A and the potential for leadership to either alleviate or exaggerate these challenges. Very invaluable information. Thank you for sharing your expertise with us today.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And to our listeners, thank you for tuning in to this episode of M&A Plus, The Art After the Deal. We hope today's episode has given you a deeper understanding of the complexities of M&As and the crucial role of leadership and wellness in these changing environments. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast on your favorite platform to stay updated on all our latest episodes. We look forward to bringing you more insights and discussions that help you navigate the corporate world with greater awareness and success. Until next time. Thank you for tuning in to another insightful episode of M&A Plus, The Art After the Deal, with your host, Lisa Scott. If you found today's discussion valuable, don't forget to subscribe for more engaging content. Connect with us on social media and visit our website to stay updated on the latest trends in mergers and acquisitions. And a special thanks to our sponsor, Intuitive Edge, your trusted partner in managed, transparent, value-driven contract services. Whether you're a private equity firm or a corporation navigating a merger, acquisition, or divestiture, Intuitive Edge is here to elevate your experience. Until next time, keep mastering the art of M&A Plus.